Hello, everyone, and welcome to the newest episode of the You Should Run podcast. I am Tony Heil, council member in Bridgeport, Pennsylvania, which is nestled not far from Philadelphia. And if you've listened to the past 80 episodes of this podcast, you know that I've spoken with people at all levels of government, from borough council like myself to mayors, judges, state legislators, and even members of Congress, and even state auditors, more than one, which is an odd office to have multiple times. But I've never had a lieutenant governor, and that changes today. And I've also never spoken with anyone from Vermont on this podcast, and that also changes today. That obviously narrows down who I could be speaking with, and that means I'm talking with the lieutenant governor of the state of Vermont, David Zuckerman. David, thank you so much for calling in today.
Tony, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Well, and thank you for calling in. I know you have a busy schedule. And you know that we talk to people about what motivated them to get into politics and, you know, what has continued to motivate and get them involved in different issues. So let's just get right into it. When did you first start to become aware and interested in politics, whether it's locally or beyond?
Well, I probably became aware of it before I became interested in it, because my mom was on the school board when I was just a teeny kid in the 70s, and she was on our local town meeting. But so there was some political discussions around the household from before I can remember, but it actually didn't really get me that interested in it, because I saw how much time it took. And then as I got into college, I was more active in a grassroots way, because I was kind of turned off to the money involved in the federal kinds of offices, and I thought basically with all the corporate money involved in politics, people couldn't really be themselves as elected office holders as my mom had been locally. And but then this gentleman came along, and he was a congressman running for re-election in 1992, and his name is Bernie Sanders, that some folks may have heard of before. Now he's been obviously on the national scene for a couple of cycles, and he just inspired me in huge ways as someone who would talk to the issues and really stay focused on what was important. And he didn't take any corporate donations at all. And that was a big deal. And he wasn't really affiliated with corporate politics and the big corporate parties. And that's really what motivated me to start volunteering. So I volunteered for him on the campus at UVM. We got almost every door knocked on campus, registered over 1,000 people to vote. And then from that, I met local people who were involved in affordable housing, minimum wage, gay and lesbian equality, justice issues, and I realized, wait a minute, you can be active on these issues as I was as a student in sort of community organizing, and you can engage in the political sphere at the same time. It's not an either or. And that's really what sort of clicked me into this whole movement politics opportunity, and it's been a ride ever since.
Now, you talk about money in politics, which I know is a big issue everywhere, but people look at Senator Sanders and they say, well, that's easy for you to say because you're from Vermont. And I don't know Vermont, aside from that one time I did a debate tournament in college there. So do you think that has money in politics permeated even the nooks and crannies of Vermont as just as much or in a different way than every other place in the country?
Well, it certainly does permeate. We do have the public financing option for governor and lieutenant governor races, but even that option has its limitations because of when you have to start running, which is often much later than other people, so they get a head start in name recognition and so forth. We do have pretty strong limits on some of the donation quantities, although not as strong as some other states. And then, you know, myself and some others have foregone corporate donations, at least for me, since I first ran in 1994, but others are doing so more so. But, you know, in smaller office, in the state legislative races in a lot of states, you still don't have to raise a ton of money. And I think the opportunity is there for people to engage by running with small donations from friends and neighbors and really doing the hard work of shoe leather politics, just door knock, one door after another for city council or board of aldermen or women for that matter, or, you know, I don't know how big the borough is that you represent, but as it gets bigger, it gets harder. And I think we still have to fundamentally address money in politics, because I think that's really at the root of much of the hostility that we see in politics.
Well, we just saw a huge scandal, I'm sure you're aware of, in Ohio. A state legislative, the head of the state legislature was taking $60 million in bribes, and it was tied to legislation. So I'm sure his own race may not have cost millions of dollars to run, but people don't realize that that money can make a big impact in a negative way at all levels of government.
Well, that kind of money is, that's just outrageous. I mean, I guess if he was a speaker or leader of a chamber, he's got a strong enough hand to move policy. Most legislators don't have enough clout to warrant that kind of bribery. Although in Vermont, we're pretty small scale. I've not seen anything like that kind of bribery, or if you do this, I'll pay you for that. You know, it's never so direct as that, although maybe it is in Ohio. It's typically more that someone who has an interest and has a financial interest starts to give bigger and bigger donations, and particularly if they can give corporate donations, because, of course, corporate donations are deductible as a business expense, which should already raise red flags for people when the donations that individuals give are not deductible. I don't think any donation should be deductible. If suddenly a business didn't get a business deduction for giving $500,000 to, you know, political influencing, then I'm not sure they would give $500,000, because suddenly it's no longer an expense on the books for them, and they don't get to get the tax write-off. But they still do get, they get what they pay for. I mean, I worked for 15 years to help pass Vermont's first the only GMO labeling law in the country. That I did as a legislator, along with being lieutenant governor. I was in the legislature for 18 years, 14 in the House and 4 in the Senate. And after 15 years, we passed the GMO labeling law. And that law was making it through the courts successfully. And it then in Washington, D.C., with $120 million of lobbying, the seed industry, the agrochemical industry, the grocery manufacturers and chambers of commerce, after $120 million of lobbying, undercut our law. So money does have, unfortunately, a huge influence, not only in the donation side, but also on the lobbying side, which often are fairly intertwined.
So you talk about your experience in the legislature, which I think is so important to the success of other offices many times. But you were a young person when you ran for state legislature, right? What motivated you as a young person to run for the legislature? And would you use that experience to encourage other young people to do it?
Well, yeah, I was 23, or actually 22 when I started running. I turned 23 because I'm a summer child. And I lost. In 1994, I lost by 59 votes in my first run for the legislature, but I was actually inspired to run by being asked to run. I still was much more interested in organizing and volunteering, and it didn't even cross my mind, and I know a lot of women talk about this, sort of needing to be asked. I didn't necessarily need to be asked, but it hadn't crossed my mind yet, and when asked, I thought, wow, that's an opportunity. The district is relatively small. It's a university district where I'm a student and have been active. And I did try to run, and I did run, and I lost. But then I ran a second time. And I think there's a few things to motivate and sort of hopefully encourage and inspire young people to run. First, I would say run for an office that's of a scale that you can tackle the challenge of both running and serving. Sometimes we get a little excited and try to go for a really big office that gets a lot of media, and I just think it's really hard to break in that way. I think going for local office and then showing the public once you're in office that you can get the job done and bring fresh ideas and rational conversation to the table, that's what's going to open the doors to run for bigger and bigger office. And it gives you an experience on the ground with door knocking. I mean, now that I'm lieutenant governor, I don't really, well, with COVID, nobody's really door knocking, but when I ran for lieutenant governor a couple of years ago, it wasn't so much a door-knocking shoe leather campaign anymore. It was going to fairs and festivals and meeting people face-to-face, but you really do get something from holding a more local office where you're doing that face-to-face, neighbor-to-neighbor conversation.
Yeah, I was just talking to someone else, multiple people this week, about how much I miss door-knocking. Normally, at this time of the year, I'd be knocking at all my neighbor's door to make sure they're registered, and now I feel like no one would answer or would not come across well. It's a hard thing for all campaigns right now.
Yeah, I think so. I do think as we've learned more, and in Vermont we've got very low COVID rates, just partly because we're a very rural state. We don't have any urban dense areas, partly because our governor's done quite a good job in most facets. There's some that I disagree with him. We have a governor and myself are of different parties and of some different mindsets, but he's a very decent person. But we've done really well here, and so some people are starting to do in-person. But what I would say is you'd probably want to have a glove on, knock on a door, step back 10 feet from the porch, talk to them from 10 feet away with a mask on. You know, even though some of the science, you don't necessarily have to have a mask on at that distance, I think it just is a good signal of respect for people. And one maybe could do so, but maybe down in, you know, eastern Pennsylvania, I don't know what the numbers are like down there, but I think it's a hard thing to do. We've had one big rally, and we had everybody stay by their car, and we parked each car multiple feet apart from other cars in a big farm field, and I was up on a wagon at the front of it. There's some news about it, and we have a drone photo from above, and we had 100 cars and big speakers, and we piped it in like a drive-in theater where you could listen on your FM radio. But we really kept track of where everybody was parked and which on our volunteer team was bringing them their meal or going in and checking with them with masks on to bring them our stuff. So we had contact trace through every single line of cars. It's an incredibly important thing to do from a safety perspective, but also made the event really hard to pull off.
Yeah, logistics that no one knew how to do a year ago. And, you know, you have things where if you talk to a campaign veteran, they know how to stage an event, but that's not something it's in their wheelhouse.
That's right.
But so you got into the state legislature, and I imagine the state legislature in Vermont is unique, just like every other state. But what were some of the issues that motivated you as a legislator, and did any of that change over time because you understood, you know, the workings of the state government type of thing?
I would say the issues I was working on didn't change over time, but some of the tactics and methods have probably shifted with experience. So when I went in, I was very interested in income inequality, the climate and environmental issues, social injustices, and so forth. And I've continued to fight for those and work on those for now 22 of the last 24 years, except for the two-year break when I moved and had to leave the house. But the tactics are probably slightly different. I entered as a member of a third party called the Progressive Party, and for 14 years served as a member of the Progressive Party in the House. And then in the Senate and Lieutenant Governor's office, I've run both in the Democratic and Progressive primaries and run as a hybrid candidate, as a Progressive/Democrat, which maybe I'm your first one of those, too.
Mm-hmm.
And in that time, you know, I've learned as a progressive, I was a little more bombastic with my speeches and a little more damning of sort of everybody in other parties. And there are very decent people, especially in the state legislative level, that, you know, the two choices are Democrat or Republican. And so they run in those parties, and they're decent people. They're not bought off or, you know, corporatized or so forth. But they sometimes get reined in by leadership in terms of how far they'll go on amendments. And I used to be more bombastic with my commentary about them as a whole, and now I really think of each member as an individual and try not to generalize as much. So it's more about tactics and really understanding where people's comfort levels are, and then how do you push people a little farther? And generally, information helps, but so does work in their district with their constituents. And so I've always worked on a grassroots level all across the state, well outside my own district, building support for the issues I've been fighting for so that those district citizens would then call their own reps and senators and ask them to go farther. And that often has led to more success than me just saying it straight to their face and saying, why don't you go farther? Well, my district isn't ready. So I would go to their district and help them realize their district was more ready by calls from their constituents.
Yeah, I have a friend who I know in politics, and he's newer to it, and he keeps saying, I saw that our congresswoman is working on canceling $10,000 in student debt. I feel like that might, you know, turn off some voters. And I'm like, well, actually, if you look at voters, they're more progressive on this and other issues than you think. It's just, you know, that's actually a very popular position. But being in politics, you think that the very, very safe way is the popular way.
Well, and there's a lot of guidance now that I've run in both parties' primaries. There's often guidance to be sort of safe in one's language when running so that you don't offend anybody. But what I've often found is that in serving, that gives you a lot less guidance. And so in my campaigns, I've always done it much the way I learned from my mentor, Bernie. Say exactly what you think. And there's a lot of people who are going to disagree with you on an issue or two, but they're going to really respect that you're straightforward about your issues and that you're not a finger to the wind or sort of a politician that doesn't say anything specific so you can get elected. But then they never really know what you're going to do when you're there. And I have found people that completely disagree with me say to me, I vote for you because you say exactly what you think, and I'd rather have someone be direct and clear than all wishy-washy. And then, of course, other people vote for me because they very much agree with the issues. And somehow, that's been successful so far, and people have tended to support what I've been fighting for because, again, sort of the weird, and it's almost dangerous to say this, but the weird overlap between Bernie and Trump is that they're both speaking to struggling working-class people and the economic challenges people face. One is presenting a very divisive, angry message that I think is tearing us apart, and that would be our current president. The other is saying, look, most people are struggling. We need to have an economy and a government that works for everybody, and that's Bernie. But it's similar people that hear the message, because when you're struggling and you're having a hard time making it economically because there just aren't the jobs out there that pay well enough, and your landlord's rents are too high, and your bills are too high, and you're stressed all the time, that's the struggle most people face. And if you talk straight to it and give people possible solutions, they're going to listen.
Yeah, I feel like from yesterday I had a conversation with a teacher who's running for office in Pennsylvania, and it seems like the specifics of your policy goals for most offices might be less important than your perspective from that. Like, if you're coming out to people, because you can talk to someone who's on that fence of either blaming immigrants or blaming China or and sucking up to dictators or looking at the corruption issues, it's very easy to just be swayed one way or the other with who's talking to you. Do you think that it's your perspective that matters more than, you know, the detailed policy? Not the policy is not important, but just the perspective that you're bringing across and the authenticity?
Well, I think it's a combination of the two. You really do have to be as authentic and straightforward as you can be with who you are, what your perspective is, what your background is, and what you want to see get done, and your integrity. You know, people want to know that what you're telling them is what you truly believe. And I think when you look at Washington, and you look at the world of what's sort of called transactional politics, where in the moment you do what you need to do, whether or not it fits with what you said you were going to do or being ethical in any way, that really loses people's faith in the individual. Mm-hmm. And then eventually, unfortunately, it's also losing people's faith in the institution. You know, when I look at what Senator McConnell did with a Supreme Court decision and justice during, you know, the full year of the last year of President Obama's presidency, and then now saying, if we get an opening, we're going to ram it through no matter what, there's just incredible hypocrisy there. You know, do one or the other, but to just shift every single moment for what's transactionally beneficial to your agenda really makes people lose faith in the value of the institution, the norms of the institution, the respect of the institution. And what's dangerous about that is if we see a breakdown, and unfortunately we are seeing a breakdown, in people's faith that their views have a right to be heard and will be heard, whether or not they're the view that is ultimately the victorious view is a different matter. But if people feel like their voice and their position is just completely dismissed and the system doesn't care and people who are in it don't care about any kind of respect for norms, then we are in really big trouble. Because you can have all the police in the world, people are going to start saying, you know, forget the system, we're going to go back to an anarchistic kind of way. And that's I think, going to cause a lot of people a lot of harm.
Well, I feel like people like Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump want you to not believe in government, right? Like, Donald Trump promotes a lot of crazy conspiracy theories that I can't even comprehend. Some of his allies either support those conspiracies or don't deny them. And if they're the party that says that government shouldn't help you, you know, it kind of, they want people to distrust it. It seems like right now the argument isn't like liberal versus conservative or progressive versus moderate, whatever. It's more making government work or demolishing government.
Well, absolutely. And unfortunately, demolishing an entropy is far easier to create than faith in the system and order and, you know, a process that people can believe in. And, you know, even Donald Trump is a symptom mm-hmm. of, you know, 30-odd years of this activity of really destroying faith in what the government structure can be, which is kind of ironic that, you know, the president right now is touting some great moment in U.S. history as Make America Great Again. Well, in the 40s and 50s, there was incredible respect for governance, and there were huge social investments in the highway system and telecommunications and in efforts to build, well, some levels of equality. There were huge racist inequalities happening out of the GI Bill after the war and others, but there was far more faith that government was an entity that was for the collective good for all of us, and that as some benefited, everybody would benefit. Again, let's recognize the reality of the whiteness and some of those issues. But he says Make America Great Again to a time period when there was far more faith in government and far higher marginal tax rates on the wealthy to generate the money to implement those policies. So there's just a lack of understanding of history, along with a lack of understanding of just about anything on his part mm-hmm. in terms of the role of government, although unfortunately he is brilliant in his manipulation.
Yeah, very unfortunate. Now, you were in the legislature trying to make things work and often successful. What made you decide to run for lieutenant governor? Because that is a position that I think people don't think about aspiring to or attempting.
Yeah, it's a very different office. I really enjoyed being in the legislature. You get to, at least on the Vermont scale, you're the one at the table negotiating with your colleagues, discussing the issues, looking at the wording, and really taking testimony and listening to incredible information. If you are a curious person, being in the legislature is a phenomenal job because you just are inundated with information. And I really enjoyed being in the Senate, where with fewer senators, you can often get more done because you've only got to convince 15 others to support something and you've got the majority. Whereas in the House, you had to convince 75 other people. The idea of serving statewide as someone who's been organizing statewide during my full 18 years in the House and then the Senate felt like an opportunity to really help move issues in the soft outside way as opposed to the, quote, inside negotiations. And the office opened, and we had a pretty robust primary, but having worked with people in their living rooms all over the state on GMOs and cannabis reform and raising the minimum wage and universal health care for 18 years meant that I had made connections all over the state that luckily paid off for a strong grassroots campaign. And serving as lieutenant governor is just a really interesting different job than being a legislator, because you don't vote on bills unless there's a tie. But I have a deep appreciation, being a New Englander, where sort of democracy started, in a really fair process and making sure that ideology doesn't supersede process. Because again, as I said earlier, if you lose faith in the process, then whatever comes through as laws is almost moot.
Yeah, you talk about New England having its history and its reputation, but Vermont actually had a reputation for the longest time of being a Republican state, right? Like the only senator that's been elected as a Democrat is Pat Leahy, I think. And I think that people don't realize that the politics of Vermont today may not even be the same as they were when you first ran, right? It's an evolving state more so than people realize.
Well, very much so. I mean, we're seeing states right now start to move from one side of the aisle to another, or from a trifecta to split and continuing to move in one way or another. Vermont is still a very rural state, and rural areas tend to be a little more independent-minded in terms of smallness of government, and I can get by on my own mentality. But it's also always been a very communitarian kind of state, where it wasn't government solving the problems, but people did come together in their communities, either through their religious institutions or granges or other community opportunities. If someone's barn burned, there were barn raisings, and people would come together. And I think there's a real value to that tradition. But Vermont in the late 60s and early 70s had a very big migration from the urban areas to the south, part of the Back to the Land movement. And I do think that had a big effect on a shift in the electoral side. And that shift has continued for many years. In fact, right now, there's the fewest Republicans in the House and the Senate that I think have ever been. And our current Republican governor is the last sort of last Republican standing in a high office in the state, which is the challenge I'm taking on right now to run for governor.
Yeah. So, and getting to that, what is your motivation right now? What do you want to accomplish? And, you know, what should people paying attention to as a result?
Well, when I got into the race in January, I've moved from the last 4 years as lieutenant governor, donning a metaphorical hat as an ambassador for democracy, because I got elected lieutenant governor the same night in 2016 as this current president. And so the options of policy progression really disappeared or shrank with his election. But the importance of going around the state and working for the faith and democracy kind of was a big piece of these 4 years. But what that also meant was that our current governor, who is a very reasonable Republican, not one of the types that we maybe see in other parts of the country that were still, dissing on masks and really not following any science for many, many months on the COVID crisis. He's a decent guy and does the right thing when severe issues come before him. But there's very little vision. He's very much a laissez-faire. Things are working. The government, the economy was going along okay. But when I got in, I was talking about the fact that half the state's still living paycheck to paycheck. He'd vetoed the minimum wage. He'd vetoed a paid family leave bill. He'd vetoed a 24-hour waiting period to purchase guns. And he'd vetoed a medical monitoring bill because we had a huge toxic PFOA, PFAS contamination in a county of Vermont from a Teflon-using facility. And we felt that the company that knew the dangers of those chemicals should be responsible for monitoring the medical circumstance of those people affected.
Yeah, that's a big issue here, too.
And, so there's a number of issues that I felt, most people said politically, wait two more years, the seat's going to open, then you'll be a front runner for that seat, you've got an easy re-election for lieutenant governor, why take this on? And I said, because I've never been in office to sit back while it was easy. I've always been in office to push forward and advocate for issues and get things done. And between the climate crisis and the lack of time we have to address that, I've got a 14-year-old daughter, the fact that I'm also an organic farmer growing vegetables and animals and facing severe weather events all of these last few years that are just getting worse and worse, waiting two more years just isn't an option. And so I got in to raise these issues of economic justice and climate issues, particularly in rural Vermont. And now, of course, we've also got a health crisis, and it rekindles the universal health care conversation. And no doubt, problems for centuries, but elevated by the killing, the murder of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and others. It says it's time to address our social inequities and racial justice inequities. And, Vermont needs someone who's going to be leading on these issues and is far more aware of them and doesn't need to sort of come up to speed and make minor adjustments. It's time to make bigger adjustments.
You know, I've talked many times on this podcast about the effects of climate change all over the country. And I feel like people think climate change and they think sea level rise. This week was actually a pretty big story that didn't get enough attention about new sensitivity models showing more certainty about temperature rise in general. But higher temperatures and climate change could have a very serious impact on Vermont, right? Since that's so important, can you explain about what that would mean for rural communities in Vermont?
Well, absolutely. We are a very agricultural and natural resource-based state, not fossil fuels the way the Dakotas are, but up on the surface. We have a huge tourism interest with the fall foliage and maple trees, and we're going to see over the next 30 or 40 years a real migration of our forests farther to the north, so that will disappear as far as Vermont's tourism, you know, fall foliage. It's like one of the biggest known things about Vermont. Our dairy industry that relies on, you know, decent rainfall and regular growing seasons to put up really good hay and grass. You know, we had one of the hottest May and Junes, and on my vegetable farm, we've lost thousands and thousands of dollars of seeds that just didn't germinate well because it didn't rain for weeks and weeks, and even though we irrigated, that's not the same. And then it was almost 100 degrees in June, which is just way out of normal for up here. Our ski season, you know, Vermont's one of the big ski states in the country and certainly in the Northeast.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, you know, you've got some skiing in the Poconos and so forth down there in Pennsylvania. There may not even be seasons anymore, you know, in the next decade because there's just so little natural snow falling and not even cold enough air to make much snow down that way, I imagine.
Yeah, people forget here, we really didn't have more than a few snowflakes this winter. It happened, but no one remembers because of all the other news that happened.
Right, exactly. So ski industry, agricultural industry, foliage industry, maple syrup, which is related to the foliage industry, all of these things are going to be severely impacted by the climate migration and climate change issues.
Yeah, and I think it really to me, as important as COVID is, and it is important, it will go away at somewhat level, whether it's hopefully in the next 5 minutes after this call, or more likely in a few months or weeks. But the climate crisis is definitely the one issue that is not going away by any wishful thinking or even just a few months of science.
And the scale of the consequences actually, I think, will eventually make COVID pale, which is what's really frightening to me. Think about the major disruption of COVID-19 and take that, and instead of compressing it as COVID did, which was very sudden over a couple months, we're sort of like the boiling frog where the impact of the climate crisis is going to have a much greater impact over time. And already around the world, we're seeing tens of millions of climate refugees. When you look at most of the refugees in the world, it isn't war or religion. It's actually climate adjustments, whether it's coastal areas flooding or spreading desertification. And we're going to see the heat in southern parts of this country start driving people north. We're going to see diseases coming up farther out of the tropics. All of these things are going to compound with the climate crisis if we don't start doing something about getting carbon out of the atmosphere, which is actually one of the things I've talked about with regenerative agriculture. There's an opportunity with good agricultural practices to probably sequester more carbon than almost any other technological solution.
Yeah, I mean, people have talked about how the Syrian civil war may have been the first climate war, and people didn't realize it. I don't know that it was the first or not, but that was a serious...
That's not my expertise, but could be.
And also, there's news and talk that the worsening climate may have been worsened COVID, especially in Israel, where they brought back school, but it was so hot they had to keep air conditioning on and couldn't keep masks on. And they thought that maybe the AC with no masks made the disease worse. So people, the impact of this is so vast that it's hard to keep track of.
Well, fair enough. And I don't know the science behind that, although I have heard that, you know, cooler air, the little virus particles live longer. So that could be an issue if you've got air conditioning going on, as well as the air circulation not bringing in fresh air and recirculating air that other people have breathed into and potentially dispersed virus particles. All those things make sense to me, even though I haven't seen the studies on that exact aspect.
Right. Well, big problems require people to run for big office and for smaller office. And so I appreciate that you have run and you're continuing to run. David, if people want to know more about you and follow, your progression, where should they go to learn more and potentially get involved?
Sure. I appreciate that. If they want to learn about the office I'm in, they can search Lieutenant Governor of Vermont and go to the website and reach out. And then also, if you're interested in my campaign for governor, you can visit Zuckerman for Vermont, which is ZuckermanForVT.com, and Zuckerman is ZuckerMan. But you could Google this. You know, the world of Google makes it a lot easier than in search engines than it was 20 years ago to find out about somebody. But yeah, you can find the campaign, reach out. Certainly anybody who wants to donate, I'd love it. But if you just have questions about it, we're always happy to answer those as well. And I really appreciate the opportunity.
And one last question. It's the You Should Run podcast. Can you just give briefly, why should other people consider running for office? Probably not now in 2020, but maybe ramp up to run in 2021 and 22. What would be your words of encouragement for running for office right now?
Well, you know, there's an old famous saying, be the change you want to see. And part of that is, if you want to see change in government, we need to have different people in government, or the people who are in it move into better roles to implement the ideas that you agree with them on. And we will only have a government that represents the range of people that exist if a wider range of people run. That's a class discussion, that's a race discussion, that's a gender discussion. And I think there's more opportunity now, with more fear and danger as well, unfortunately, because of both the emotional danger for some, the social media sort of attack narrative that we have. But at the same time, there's more excitement about new views coming in that I think it's a really ripe opportunity. The ground has been prepared and fertilized for people to step into it and grow. I love to use farming metaphors. I apologize.
No, it's fine.
But I do think that there's a wave. We're on a tipping point. You know, put your hands together, make a big steep mountain, like an old, a new mountain in the Swiss Alps or something, with big sharp peaks, or out by the Tetons. You know, those of us who live in the eastern part of the country, we've got old, wise, rounded mountains. But you go out to those jagged mountains, look at the peak and that tip. And we are literally in this election cycle on a tipping point where we're going to fall backwards and roll way down the hill and have a long way to go to get that back out of that hole. Or we're going to tip forwards and we're going to tip into a new valley and a new opportunity. And I think right now the wind is at our backs and we're going to tip forwards. But I would hope people, if they're thinking of running now, we'll get involved in local campaigns and help people now, so you can start to learn the ins and outs and the effort that it takes and some of the depth on some of the issues, so that you can be better prepared to run in the future. And a lot of people who run get their toes wet by getting involved and really learning more about it by helping people that they agree with. And if you don't see someone you agree with running, think about running next time.
Exactly. That's the perfect answer. I appreciate it. Thank you so much, David Zuckerman. And I hope that if you're listening, you found some encouragement and learned a little bit. And maybe you will decide to run for office, too. Thank you so much.